Well, I would like to thank the organizers of the DDDAS 2020 for the opportunity to present this keynote lecture. I've given the title Revisiting the Top 10 Ways that DDDAS Can Save the World, with an update on the bioinfosciences area and on the energy bridge. It actually links to two presentations I gave in earlier symposia back in 2014 and 2016. So if I can go to the next slide, slide number two. In 2014, at the ASME conference, which was also where DDDAS 2014 was held in Buffalo, New York, that was the first time I used the title, Top 10 Ways That DDDAS Can Save the World, to share with the community that there were great opportunities for the impact of DDDAS in terms of a broad societal impact. And whenever I use a slide from that 2014 presentation, I'll use that golden rectangle on the upper right-hand corner. It says 2014 and Buffalo. And so that way you'll know that I'm referring back to an earlier presentation as opposed to a new material for the talk today. And then in 2016, I gave an update at the conference in Hartford, Connecticut. So when I use a slide from that presentation, you'll see on the upper right-hand corner, 2016 in Hartford. And the title of that presentation was New Challenges for DDDAS for Broad Societal Impact. I'll go to slide number three. Disclaimer that these are ideas, especially for the younger members of this community, in terms of great research opportunities at the intersection of DDDAS and various areas of research. And this is just things that are my opinion. So things that have no proof and are 100% my opinion. So slide number five. The whole point of this talk, both in 2014, 2016, and now in 2020, is areas that I believe, in my opinion, have career scale challenges where DDDAS is likely to inject significant new insights. And conversely, those advances could also help evolve the capabilities of DDDAS as well. And combined together, this progress is going to have great societal impact. And so that's going to be, again, the main theme of this presentation is areas where I think there are great opportunities. As many of you know, I myself am not an expert or practitioner of DDDAS, but is someone who has seen the tremendous progress that this community has contributed over the past two decades and would like to see that continue. Slide number six then. Back in 2014, it was supposed to be a dramatic countdown from areas where the DDDAS community has made significant impact. Many of these projects at the toward the bottom of the list, 10, 9, 8, so on, were funded at the time of the NSF ITR in the year 2000. And finally, culminating in number one, I introduced the opportunity of epigenetics. I called it dynamic data-driven DNA application systems, because the epigenome and the way the genome interacts with the environment, you think about the blueprint that's in the DNA as the program, and how it dynamically interacts with its environment. And that dynamic interaction determines which genes get turned on and off so that different cells develop differently. And you, therefore, you get the cell-to-cell differentiation and ultimately the organization of living organisms in terms of tissues and organs and so forth. And so this exciting area of epigenetics, there are so many parallels between epigenetics when we try to model that using biophysical principles and some of the basic ideas of DDDAS. And so the basic idea that was presented in 2014 and earlier at a talk at DDDAS 2010 is that DDDAS could actually be a very good framework for advancing epigenetic mathematical models. And conversely, insights from epigenetics might give us new ideas about the DDDAS framework. So the impact can go in both directions. And my challenge in that 2014 presentation was to encourage researchers from the two communities, the biophysics and biological sciences, to collaborate and communicate with the experts in DDDAS. Now, if we go to slide number 7, in Hartford, 2 years later, I gave a presentation focusing on what I felt were the areas that were undergoing rapid advances. And I specifically talked about epigenetics again, but I also talked about the oil and gas shale revolution through hydraulic fracture. And so those were the two areas that were highlighted back in 2016. And we'll revisit that. And again, I'll use the label 2016 Hartford in the upper right-hand corner to remind us that those were our slides that I presented earlier 4 years ago. And then, of course, those slides without such a label will be the new material. So back in 2016, it was already apparent that the U.S. was undergoing a very significant energy transformation or energy revolution. And what I presented back in 2016, it was actually an article from the Financial Times that had appeared a few months earlier that tried to explain the enormous success of the shale revolution in the United States by drawing a comparison between the economics of oil production from shale versus the economics of oil production from large-scale offshore drilling. A large offshore oil platform, a moderate size, is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. These infrastructure projects can take 5 years or more to develop. But once they're developed, of course, there's massive amounts of oil that's produced. So basically, it's the classic scenario of a very high risk, but also very high reward if you're successful. Now, in contrast, a shale well, oil well in a shale formation might cost about $5 million to drill with a payback period of about 5 months. But of course, you can drill many such wells. Now, the disadvantage, of course, is that each of these wells only produce for a few years. You have to keep drilling new wells. But the interesting observation that was made in the Financial Times and subsequent developments have largely borne this out, is that because the time scale matches the futures contract, the shale production can hedge their risk by basically locking in a profitable price using the futures market. And so that economic advantage meant that as the, for example, when OPEC tried to produce an oil glut by shutting down production, it turns out the weakest link was not the shale formation, but large offshore projects. Because of course, you cannot hedge massive amounts of production 5 years in the future on the futures market. There's no one willing to take the other side of that trade. And so for that reason, in the efforts to clamp down on the American oil revolution, what actually happened was the offshore oil production got knocked out, and in some sense made the shale producers even stronger. And so that particular strategy of trying to suppress the price of oil was abandoned, and oil prices before the onset of COVID-19 went back to the $50 to $60 range. Okay. So much of the, with the exception of the unexpected pandemic from COVID-19, much of the oil and gas landscape and the energy landscape pretty much played out as we projected back in 2016. Okay, now if we go to slide number 9, but even in 2016, though, there were some significant issues and challenges that were apparent, especially in the downstream side of the oil and gas sector, namely what happens at the refinery. Because of the unusual nature of oil production from shale, it turns out to be a very significant amount of the hydrocarbons that are produced or can be produced or found in those deposits are light hydrocarbons. So the U.S. refinery infrastructure was caught by surprise, because until the shale revolution, the working assumption had been that the U.S. Feedstock into our refineries would become increasingly heavier oil, such as the oil from the tar sands in Alberta, Canada. And so the refineries had been transformed or upgraded to process very heavy oil. In retrospect, the energy landscape went in the opposite direction. There was a glut of light hydrocarbons. And in fact, not only light hydrocarbons, but some of the light hydrocarbons are stranded at the production sites because being gaseous in nature, it's too dangerous to transport them to the refineries. Okay. So now at the time, we projected 10 million barrels per day as a nice round number. Subsequently, by 2018, 2019, the U.S. production actually went up to 13 million barrels a day. And the U.S. actually overtook Saudi Arabia and Russia to become the number one oil-producing nation in the world. Okay? And with that increased production, the challenge of all this excess light hydrocarbons became even bigger. Now, at the time that the this analysis was first considered, the economic value of the light stranded hydrocarbon was estimated to be about $20 billion a year left in the oil fields, left on the table. By the time we reached 13 million barrels a day and much higher oil prices in that booming economy, the economic impact or the economic value of the light hydrocarbons that was left behind was estimated to be about $40 billion per year. Okay. So as I suggested back in 2016, if you did a search on the simple phrase, too much ethane, you would literally get thousands of hits, many, many articles and websites talking about the glut of ethane, because we're producing or capable of producing so much more than consumption. So what was normally a valuable hydrocarbon resource actually was priced negative prices at the oil well. It was actually a liability rather than a product. It's just a remarkable transformation of the energy landscape until the, of course, the onset of COVID-19 and the economic slowdown. Okay, slide number 10. So because of this opportunity, a group of universities led by Purdue had formed this Center for the Innovative and Strategic Transformation of Alkane Resources, with the acronym CSTAR, to address this problem of the stranded light hydrocarbons. And the basic idea is to create new technologies and new infrastructure, think of them as small refineries, closer to the wellhead so that you can safely convert these stranded gases into liquids And then once they're in liquid form, it's safer to transport them to the refineries so that all the stranded light hydrocarbons eventually find their way to the refinery and ultimately to the consumers, and therefore tap into that $40 billion a year in stranded light hydrocarbons. And the basic theme back in 2016 of my presentation was that the DDDAS was a natural framework for the systems design of these mini refineries closer to the wellhead. Okay. And the acknowledgement in terms of this idea was, the Center for Innovative and Strategic Transformation of Alkane Resources with Fabio Ribeiro, professor at the University of Purdue, as the center director. He and I had many discussions about this idea, which I shared back in 2016. Now, if we go to slide number 11, about a year later, in September of 2017, the NSF finished a 2-3 year evaluation process for the engineering research centers, and CSTAR, which had been one of the proposals and actually one of the finalists, was actually selected as one of the four engineering research centers in the class of 2017. And so the NSF agreed with our vision and the opportunity and awarded this team just under $20 million over 5 years to develop this technology to go after those stranded light hydrocarbons. And what's an interesting anecdote, because I actually could not mention that back in 2016 because the award had not been decided or finalized, is that one of the reviewers, one of the anonymous reviewers, they liked the work, but they actually thought that the framework for the operation and optimization of these mini refineries should be using DDDAS. And they actually asked, why didn't we use the DDDAS paradigm? Which, of course, they're preaching to the choir, because I'm a very big fan of the power of this paradigm. But I'm not formally a member of the CSTAR team. I am the head of the chemical engineering department that hosts the ERC. So clearly, I work closely with the center and help them in terms of understanding the power and potential of DDDAS. But in the original core proposal, it is correct that DDDAS was actually not mentioned as the central paradigm that the operation of the mini refineries would employ. So if we go to slide number 12, I can actually show some of the elements from that proposal, which I could not show in 2016. So in the upper part of this diagram is the traditional infrastructure of large projects producing large amounts of oil from centralized production facilities, and then those liquids ultimately finding their way to the large centralized refineries. But in the context of shale, this paradigm, as I said before, leaves behind $40 billion worth of stranded light hydrocarbons. In fact, we can actually think of it as stranded hydrogen, because the light hydrocarbons are a very hydrogen-rich resource. And if you can get them to the consumer, so if they're not stranded, it's actually a much better form of energy, because of course, when you convert that into energy sources, energy use, because of the higher hydrogen to carbon ratio, you actually produce water instead of carbon dioxide. So if you can get it safely to the consumer, it is actually stranded hydrogen. It's actually a very large reservoir of stranded hydrogen. And so you can also think of CSTAR as a mega project engineering research center to go after stranded hydrogen. And of course, the challenge is that this infrastructure of distributed refineries close to the production sites, closer to the wellhead, does not exist today. Today, all the refineries are massive centralized infrastructure. So the basic idea proposed by C-STAR is to create small modular units that are mass produced to drive down the cost, use principles from process intensification, and that these units are not only small, but small enough that, and small and modular, so that they can be moved from well to well, as each of these particular wells have a relatively short life. So as you move your production around, this infrastructure can follow to wherever the production is occurring. And this is really where the dynamic nature of the challenge comes in. Because in the shale formations, there are spatial variation in terms of the composition of the light hydrocarbons. And over the lifetime, the 2-3 year lifetime of an oil production site, there will also be variations in composition with respect to time. So the optimum operation of this infrastructure, of these mini refineries, so to speak, will require a dynamic strategy that recognizes the dependence on both space and time. And of course, you have all these sensors and data sources that are detecting the changing composition. And so you have the classic framework that sets it up for DDDAS. Okay. And so those who are expert, have the expertise in DDDAS, immediately see this connection, which is why one of the reviewers on this center's proposal picked up on that. So if we go to the next slide, slide number 13. So back in 2016, the final presentation, the final theme was the emerging opportunities and observations of how the DDDAS community had responded to my earlier presentations about the opportunities at the interface between epigenetics and dynamic data-driven application systems. And there were already a few presentations at that 2016 meeting, collaborations across the two communities. Now, my original thought was in 2020, I could give an update on epigenetics. But of course, in the past few months, essentially since the economic disruptions that occurred from March, the entire world, and certainly life in the US, has revolved around the challenge of dealing with COVID-19. And so again, given the potential opportunities for DDDAS, I'm actually gonna shift gears now and talk about COVID-19 and DDDS. So that will be slide number 14. COVID-19 and DDDS. And I'll create, okay, this time the golden rectangle on the upper right-hand corner says 2020 virtual, because this is actually a new slide for this meeting. I also want to acknowledge that the essential elements of this idea is actually not from me, but from my good friend, Steve Smith, who earlier in his career was a professor in EECS at UC Berkeley, but his greatest claim to fame is as founder of one of the major RFID companies in the world, Alien Technology. So an interesting challenge of dealing with COVID-19 in terms of policy, whether you think of it as a control strategy, is that it is the worst control loop imaginable. For loose control results in many deaths, so the medical consequences of loose control is unacceptable. On the other hand, tight control, especially extended tight control, will destroy the economy. And so it makes it a tremendous challenge to find the optimal path between these two undesirable outcomes. And then on top of that, the control loop involves politics, and the politics is confounded by the fact that observables have long time delays. So the connection between cause and effect it cannot be agreed upon by different parties or different people. And that is a classic example of a very difficult control problem if you have time delays. Now, on top of that, some of the key control variables, such as social distancing, have highly variable response, certainly from individual to individual. But even when you take large groups of people, a group of people, depending on their beliefs and depending on their culture and depending on their values, may have different response to the social distancing mandates. And so from a mathematical modeling perspective, trying to predict the evolution of the COVID-19 pandemic, how it rolls through our economy is a very, very difficult challenge. And so simple homogeneous models that miss important phenomena such as percolation, and that happens in such networks, and also phase transitions. If you miss important phenomena such as that, which are intrinsic in this system, then your models are likely to be off. And in fact, part of the challenge, especially in the early days of the pandemic, is that many of the widely cited models were not predictive, and they actually had a relatively poor prediction, which led to credibility issues. And so here again, I think a much more sophisticated mathematical model and ultimately guide for policymakers incorporating ideas from DDDAS are likely to lead to much better approaches to dealing with the pandemic. So in my last slide, slide 15, I'll just give one example again from Steve Smith. And although he himself did not know about DDDAS, after extensive discussion between the two of us, we came to the conclusion that the best framework for implementing this idea or some of these ideas on the next slide is in fact from DDDAS. So one of the interesting kind of macroscopic observation is that we do have examples of societies or communities or even nations that have been on the opposite ends of the spectrum with respect to their national strategy for dealing with the pandemic. So at one end of the spectrum, you have a country like Sweden, which has had a very loose strategy, loose control. And at the other end of the spectrum, you had countries like Italy and Spain, which after an initial spike of the cases and many, many deaths and overwhelming their hospital infrastructure, responded to that crisis by really clamping down on very tight controls on all activity with tremendous disruptions to their economy. So we've seen the results in terms of the impact on the cases with respect to both strategies. So an interesting question is, what happens if you employ an alternating cycle of tight and loose controls with the optimal cycle to be determined? Now, one could say that based on what we know about the coronavirus and its incubation period of roughly 2 weeks, that alternating cycle should be 2 weeks, but perhaps the actual modeling effort with the DDS will actually confirm what the optimal cycle is. So my intuition says it should be 2 weeks, but maybe a more sophisticated analysis will show some surprises. Okay. So the idea here is that such on-off approach will disrupt the loop, the mechanism by which the virus spreads. So the interesting observation here, or the hypothesis, is that during the loose part of the cycle, you allow the economy to function because all economic activity, airlines, restaurants, theaters, everything is going on, obviously, but people wearing masks and social distancing to the extent possible. But otherwise, everything is progressing in the economy. On the other hand, when you clamp down, it's a very tight clamp down for that duration of the cycle. And then the question is, would such an approach navigate between the two extremes of a severe disruption of the economy or, at the other extreme, an unacceptable medical impact and healthcare losses, health losses? So the question is whether this would actually allow us to have a functioning economy and basically allow us to limp forward to the day that the vaccine is widely available and distributed, which could still be, you know, a year or so from now. So the idea is that you actually have an acceptable performance from the economy, but at the same time, the medical impact, the loss of life, and the negative consequences from a health perspective are also met to a significant degree. Okay. So that's the hypothesis. And so this is where all the inputs in terms of the type of data that can be gathered, the uncertainty in the data, all of that fits into the DDS framework. And such a model can help guide policymakers. And most importantly, it will mitigate the difficulty of trying to use the political loop as an analog control variable. I think the last 3 or 4 months within the US, with the regional variations and the regional political variations, as well as the national dialogue, suggests that we're trying to control a very difficult control challenge with a strategy that doesn't take into account our best capabilities in mathematical modeling. So with that, I think I've used just about 30 minutes here. So this is, I think, a good place to stop. I say this is the Q&A session, but really, I don't have the answers. I'm just here to propose exciting ideas, and especially for younger members of the community with much of their career in front of them, that I think there are some tremendous opportunities to contribute to society, including our current crisis with COVID-19. So thank you very much for the opportunity to give this keynote. And I look forward to more interactions with this very dynamic community. Thank you.